This is the TriDot Podcast. TriDot uses your training data and genetic profile combined with predictive analytics and artificial intelligence to optimize your training, giving you better results in less time with fewer injuries. Our podcast is here to educate, inspire, and entertain. We'll talk all things triathlon with expert coaches and special guests. Join the conversation and let's improve together.
Brand new episode of the TriDot Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. It's going to be a good one today. I have two friends from Precision Fuel and Hydration with us, and we will be talking about how to fuel different types of races. We are a triathlon podcast, but I would say that most triathletes at some time or another dabble in other adventures throughout the year. Does our fueling strategy need to change for road running, ultra running, cycling, swim-only events, adventure races, and so much more that we can get into? We'll find out what the team from PF&H have learned. Our first guest is a crowd favorite, Andy Blow from Precision Fuel and Hydration. Andy is a sports scientist with a degree in sports and exercise science from the University of Bath, an expert in sweat, dehydration, and cramping. Andy has worked with multiple Formula One racing, NBA, NBL, MLB, and Premier League sports teams, as well as many professional triathletes. An elite-level triathlete in his younger days, Andy has finished in the top 10 of Ironman events, as well as winning an Xterra world title. Andy, welcome back to the TriDot Podcast.
Good to be back, Andrew. How are you doing?
I am doing well. I will note for the people, Andy, we were supposed to catch up and record this conversation in Kona, and we were busy. Y'all were busy. We never crossed paths, and so here we are doing it remotely. But it was good to see you there on the island. Did you guys have a good time in Kona?
Yeah, too many dolphins to swim with and turtles to find time to record a podcast. So we had some good excuses.
Also joining us from the Precision Fuel and Hydration team is Emily Errol. Emily is a sports scientist at PF&H with a first-class BSc honors degree in sports and exercise science from the University of Bath. She first joined the team a couple of years ago as an intern alongside her degree. Emily comes from a team sport background, having played football from a young age and playing in the top female university league in Bath. Since joining the team, she has worked with PF&H's elite athletes in a range of sports to help them dial in their fuel and hydration strategy. And when I did Ironman Waco, Emily was actually the one who helped me with my fueling strategy. I'm sure I'm one of the elite athletes you allude to. Isn't that right, Emily?
Absolutely, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
The elitist athlete you've ever consulted with. I am Andrew, the average triathlete, voice of the people, and captain of the middle of the pack. As always, we will roll through our warm-up question, settle in for our main set topic, and then wind things down with our cool down. Lots of good stuff. Let's get to it.
Time to warm up. Let's get moving.
When you care a great deal about a certain team, athlete, or sports story, sporting events can have an incredible power to move us emotionally. Andy, Emily, for our warm-up question today, from all of the sporting moments that you have watched, either in person or on the telly, what was a moment that especially moved you? Emily, what is this answer for you?
It's a tricky question, Andrew. I think for me, it's actually quite a recent one.
Okay.
As someone who's played a lot of football and watches a lot of football, I think it's last year, Messi winning the World Cup with Argentina.
Yeah.
Obviously, he's done a lot of great things in his career, and I watched a lot of Barcelona for years and years and kind of followed his career. And just to kind of see him reach his ultimate goal, really, it's the one thing he hadn't done, and to be able to tick that off was just a great moment to watch.
Andy Blow, what is this answer for you?
I'm gonna stick with the stereotype and the Brits talking about football and soccer, because I grew up playing beautiful game. And
sure,
the World Cup in 1990 was in Italy, and I was 12 years old. I was on holiday in France with my folks, and England, we had a great team. We had Gary Lineker, we had Paul Gascoigne. It was like real, you know, potential. And then the inevitable happened. But there was a famous moment with Gazza, Paul Gascoigne, when he committed a foul in, I think it was in the quarterfinal, which would have meant that if England had gone through, he'd have had too many cards and would have missed out. It might have even been the semi-final, he'd have missed out on the final. But I've got to get my facts straight, but I just remember the famous images of him crying. And I remember that it was only 12 years old. It's probably one of the first sporting memories I had that really stuck with me, that we were sat in the bar on the campsite in France with loads of other England supporters watching this. And yeah, it was still, the devastation was real.
And yeah,
big emotional moment for a football fan.
Well, I know the cameras are often very, very fond of capturing young children crying in the stands when something happens to their team. Could that have been you on the day, perhaps?
Absolutely, yeah.
So Andy, very interestingly, going to the I don't want to say a negative moment, but a not as happy for your team moment, but emotional nonetheless, right? I mean, emotions can be positive at the game, or they can be negative at the game based on how your team or athlete is doing. So. Very, very interesting side. We celebrate Messi with Emily. We lament what happened to Team England with Andy. And my answer here, I'm going to give a shout out to Serena Williams, American tennis player. I did also grow up playing the beautiful game. I was decent at it, not amazing at it. I was a much better tennis player. So as a tennis fan, in the last couple of years, when Serena Williams went into the U.S. Open, and it was just known by everybody, this is her last tournament and she's done. Her matches just became must-watch TV because you never knew which match was going to be Serena's last match before this historic tennis career came to an end. And so I would watch in the evenings, and she had two or three matches in a row where it looked like she could lose. And just the heart of a champion, you know, not in the best fitness, not in the best form, but just finding ways to rally past really strong opponents. She won two or three matches she probably didn't have any business winning. And just, it was fever pitch in New York City with the crowd as they were just cheering Serena on match to match to match. And obviously she finally did lose, and her career came to an end. But that was just a really, I was never specifically a Serena fan, but watching her in that tournament kind of close down her career just with such ferocity was just really, really special as a tennis fan. So I'm going to give a nod to Serena as a fairly recent memory in my mind. I was very much caught up in the hysteria of that U.S. Open run that she had. So we're going to throw this question out to you, our audience, like we always do. Make sure you're a part of the I Am Tri-Dot Facebook group. Every single Monday when the new episode comes out, I pose our warm-up question to our community. So go find the post asking you, what was a sporting moment for your favorite team, your favorite athlete, that really struck a chord with you emotionally? Can't wait to see what you have to say.
On to the main set. Going in 3, 2, 1.
We are thrilled to have Sailfish as the swim partner of Tri-Dot Training. Sailfish was founded in 2007 by Jan Sibbersen, who was on the national German team and is the fastest swimmer to ever hit the waters of Ironman. The Sailfish mission is to create premium triathlon and open water swim products. They offer swim skins, tri-suits, and swim accessories. But the core of this Sailfish product line are their award-winning wetsuits. Known for their outstanding flexibility, balanced buoyancy, and distinguished gliding properties in the water, Sailfish wetsuits are truly made to make you faster. And that certainly has been the case for me. I've swam in many different brands of wetsuits over the years, and my Sailfish is the very first one that I put on, got into the water, and clocked swim splits I had no business hitting on my own. For me, it was truly love at first stroke. With several models and price points, there for sure will be a Sailfish wetsuit that is right for you. Head to sailfish.com to check out all the neoprene goodness and use SFC-TRIDOT20 at checkout for 20% off your new wetsuit. On episode 129 of the Tri-Dot podcast, we heard all about the Precision Fuel and Hydration case studies, where they examine how an athlete fueled and hydrated during a specific race. Well, fast forward over a year or so, and they have now conducted over 400 of these studies with athletes in a variety of endurance endeavors. And so I asked Andy and Emily to join us again so we can learn from what they have learned from these studies in regards to how athletes need to fuel for different types of races. So first things first here today, for any of our listeners who are unfamiliar with the PF&H case studies, just give us a quick rundown of what these are, how they're conducted, and why you started doing them.
Yeah, absolutely. So a case study is just a a full analysis of everything an athlete eats and drinks on a race day. And what that actually entails is post-race, myself or one of the sports science team will get on normally a video call with an athlete and we'll talk through exactly what they ate and drank. So be that the morning of the race, about 30 minutes before the start of the race, then what they had during. So if that's a triathlon, that would be broken down onto what they had on the bike and then what they had on the run. And that's a lot of detail. So how many gels and the flavor of every gel, how many sips, how many bottles, everything like that. And then we also talk about the subjective details of the race. So did they have any GI issues? Did they cramp at all that kind of thing to get the whole picture. And then we take that away. We run it through some of our calculator spreadsheets that we've produced, our big database of products. And from that, we produce their headline numbers. So that's an analysis of the amount of carbohydrate they've consumed per hour, the amount of fluid that they've drank per hour, and then the relative sodium concentration of their intake. So the three levers of their kind of fueling and hydration strategy is what we call them. We also give their caffeine as well and other little bits and pieces. And from that, we look at how those numbers compare to the scientific recommendations. So are they bang on? Are they hitting what the science says they should be taking in per hour in terms of their carbohydrates? And we rate that, so we'd give that a green. Or are they just outside the recommendations? Then we'd give that an amber. Or if they're quite far outside the recommendations and maybe that could be impacting their performance, then we'd rate that a red. And we do a little bit of a write-up and say maybe what they could improve, what they could do differently next time. And that becomes a page on our website for anyone to go and have a look and see what numbers they've hit and how they've hit those numbers.
Yeah, and you're being very humble in saying you do a little write-up, because it is more than a little write-up. I find these case studies fascinating, and your social media team does a fantastic job of putting out some images that kind of show some people's headline numbers in a social media graphic. But if anybody, and I hope a lot of our audience by now, as these come up on the podcast, I hope they've gone and looked at some, because they are very, very fascinating just to kind of get they're very in-depth write-ups on what an athlete did the whole way through. Emily, have you found, at particularly some of the pros, we all know how competitive the pros are, and for them to be okay with you just really airing out their laundry on how well they fueled an event, do they ever say anything about when they're scored an orange or a red on not having fueled properly for an event?
I think so. Sometimes we do get a bit of pushback, and maybe they question some calculations. I have to prove how I've done it. But no, most of the time, I think they're quite welcoming to the feedback, and they want to work with us as a bit of a process. And once we've done it over multiple races for the same athlete, we can really see the progress that they've made.
Yeah. So Andy, take us back a step into why you started doing these in the first place, because for the brand, I mean, part of why we believe so much in PFNH products and we love working with you guys is you haven't just created a gel and an electrolyte tab and sold it and just sit back. Like you are active on the ground with athletes. You study the space. You're always working to refine your products and refine your process of how you're working with athletes. So how did the case studies become part of just your own research in the first place for you to start conducting these and posting these online?
Yeah, they started out really as the manifestation of what we were, the industrialization, if you like, of what we were doing in a very artisan way with individual athletes. So we would usually have a call with an athlete that we're working with in the build-up to event to refine their fueling and hydration plan. We'd then have a call with them after the event to debrief and gain as much detail as we could about what they ate and drank in order that we could analyze it and see if it how influential that was in what happened in their performance, what we could learn from it, and also to sort of add it to a at that point, it was kind of a figurative version of a database. You know, it was just kind of we would just have scrappy notes or Google Sheets or whatever on certain athletes, so that when they did another race the next year, we could go back to it, refine based on it. And at some point, we sat down and looked at that and went, you know what, this is like, we need a process around this if we're going to build this into something to create value, because A, it makes it easier for the athletes and for us if we've got all of the information in one place. And then what we actually found was we took one of the athletes' data and put it out on social media and put it in our newsletter. And at that point, the response that we got from people who were following us and reading our stuff was really explosive. That people were like, wow, this is super interesting. It stimulated a load of conversation and a load of feedback. And at that point, you go, that's when the marketing side of my head kicks in and goes, well, if this is really what people want to read and hear about, let's give them more of it, because it's kind of a virtuous circle. We learn more, the athletes learn more, we get people send us questions, so we get an insight into what the audience that follows us wants to know and what they want to learn, and it becomes this giant feedback loop. And full credit needs to be given to Emily in terms of taking what was, as I say, like a handmade artisan but not scalable product and sort of turning it into a solution, you know, turning it into something with a database behind it and a level of rigor and organization. And I think what's been brilliant about the process is not only have we increased the quality, the quantity of output, because we've got this industrial system behind it now, we've actually improved the quality at the same time, you know, so we're able to do a better job because M can bash into the spreadsheet if you have a Snickers bar during the race, or if you have a certain type of energy gel or a certain drink, we can put that in, the volume of it that you had, and it will immediately spit out how much carb, how much fluid, how much sodium you've consumed as a result of that, add it all up, and it takes a lot of the heavy lifting out. So yes, it's been a real sort of upgrade to the service that we can offer athletes.
Who was that very first athlete that was willing to allow their data to go out in an email form that kind of started this whole thing? Do you remember?
One of them was, I don't know if he was the very first, but one of them was Sam Appleton, the Aussie pro triathletes.
Yeah.
We published some data around Sam, I remember, from one of his early Ironman races, and also from Challenge Daytona, I think, one year. We put out stats, and at that point, it also included some other stuff around like his bike powers and whatnot, and people love reading that insight that they don't normally get. So Sam, credit to Sam, he's still an athlete on the PFNH roster and big part of what we do. So yeah, thanks to him for being a trailblazer there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I was probably at that Challenge Daytona. I'm usually at that race, so I was probably there when he was racing that one. But for the purposes of what we're talking about today, I really wanted to kind of pick y'all's brains on just how athletes are fueling for different types of events, because our athletes do run only events, they do trail events, they do ultras, they dabble in cycling only events. There's all sorts of things that somebody with an athletic endurance sports spirit can go out there and partake in. So I know in these case studies, you've done more than just triathletes. You've worked with all sorts of different types of athletes. So talk to us about the types of athletes and the events that are now in this case studies collection.
Yeah, definitely. So when Andy last spoke to you, I think we had just under 100 case studies in the database.
Yeah.
And about 40 of those were triathlon, the other a mix of different things. And now we have about 400 in the database, and I'd say 200 of those are triathlon and the rest are a mix. So we have 100 running case studies, but that's split about 50-50 between ultras and marathons.
Okay.
Cycling is one we've been looking to increase recently and get more gravel races specifically in there. We have about 50 cycling ones specifically, and then we have more niche ones as well. Some recently we've got some longer duration swims, we have some swim runs in there, but there's some little other ones as well. But in terms of the real data, there's lots on running, triathlon, and cycling. And most of them are top-level elite athletes, and a lot of the time it's success stories in these races, so they've done well. There's some where there's errors, and there is the occasional DNF, but most of the time we've worked with these athletes. We've helped them refine the strategy. As Andy said, we have a pre-race call with lots of the athletes. We help them put the plan together, so they often their strategy is quite good.
Yeah, no, very, very cool. And yeah, I'm excited to dive into it. I know we're going to hear a lot of the stories behind some of these case studies as we talk about fueling for different types of events. Andy, I am curious, because I am obviously a big fan of using Precision Fuel and Hydration products. A lot of our team, a lot of our core coaches, that is the case. And so I know, just being friends with you, talking to you often, that the feedback you get from athletes, the feedback you get as you are working on these case studies, has often influenced the product line. You've come out with new products based on what you're hearing from athletes. You've refined your products based on what you hear from athletes. So what are some examples of how you as a company have used the case studies to improve and refine the brand you have in the marketplace for athletes to consume?
Yeah, we absolutely use that because it is frontline feedback for us. So the most glaring example really is the introduction of a caffeine gel into our lineup. We were not sure about the adoption level of caffeine or not. We got some industry statistics. We even took a straw poll in the office from all the athletes. We're like, do we feel like we need a caffeinated product or not? But when we looked at the case study data, we saw that, 80% of the athletes doing longer races in our case studies were using caffeine.
Yeah,
in
sure.
Someone sort of
myself form. Included. Yeah.
So, yeah. And so immediately you get that kind of, that very, very definitive feedback that, look, if 80% of our potential customer base are likely to want to use caffeine, why are we not providing them with a product that meets that need? Why would we want them to have to go elsewhere? So the caffeine gel, which is our only caffeinated product at the moment, is you could attribute that, significantly to the work that we've done on case studies in terms of informing that. The other one more recently, which you'll have seen, is the flow gel. So we've got a gel which is of a lower viscosity. It's the same ingredients as our standard gel, which is a little bit set. And then we've re-engineered the way that we make it so that it flows better, so that you can pour it straight into a bike water bottle or into a soft flask for running. And you can carry sort of in a standard 16-ounce water bottle, you can carry over 300 grams of carbs directly. Wow. And that was in response to learning in the case studies that what a lot of athletes do in triathlon and gravel in particular is they'll empty a dozen gels into a water bottle so they've got all their energy concentrated in one place. So we figured that if a load of our audience already doing that, why not make a product that's actually made for that? Why in 2023 do we need to be squeezing 10 little tiny pouches of gel out? We don't do it with tomato sauce. You go to the restaurant and use tomato ketchup in single serves, but at home you have a big box with a squeezy lid. Why don't we do that with gel?
It's funny because right before that you had a couple of different products come out, and I saw our athlete community really excited about some of the different products, and I'm like, you guys have no idea what's about to come out when Nice France happens and the team releases this new flow gel. And I personally will be using this on course the next time I start racing middle and long again. So very, very excited about that product. But okay, let's get into our promised topic to our audience, just kind of learning from you guys on what you're learning from how athletes are fueling for different types of events. Do we need to change our strategy based on the race that we're doing, or are our numbers our numbers? Let's find out. My first question I want to ask about before we get into different types of races, let's just talk about triathlon. What have you learned in the case studies? Roughly 50% of them are triathlon events. So what have you learned from those in terms of how athletes are fueling for different distances? Does our strategy need to change, whether it's short course, middle distance, or long course? Does our strategy need to change if it's something like an Xterra or an extreme triathlon? What are you guys seeing in the data?
Yeah, we have loads of triathlon data now, and we've learned a lot from it. I think overall, the actual data and the trends are quite similar between middle and full. If we just look at kind of the overall per average carb intake, it would be relatively similar between the two. It's 80 grams per hour for full and 77 grams per hour for a half. So it seems pretty similar. That includes the swim time, the run time, the bike time. That's the overall per hour intake. But when we actually look at the breakdown from bike to run, that's where you kind of start to see some differences. And in full distance, it's a lower drop off. So it goes from 96 grams per hour on average on the bike, which is pretty high, to 73 grams per hour on the run. And then for middle, you have a greater drop off. So the average is 92 on the bike, so pretty similar on the bike to a full, but then 60 grams per hour on the run. So we see a much greater drop off in the fueling and similarly in the hydration. I think it's as you'd expect, but there's a lot of data backing that up now. So for obviously a shorter run, people are getting away with taking on less and fueling less per hour. And then if we look at different types of triathlon, it's more, the numbers are pretty similar. The headline numbers, like I say, are quite similar, and the targets would be the same for carbs. The fluid and hydration would be the sodium would be a lot more individual. But what changes more is the logistics. So how people are actually hitting those numbers, how they're carrying their nutrition, how they're breaking it up per bottles. For something like Norseman, where you get support, it's obviously a bit different how people do it, but the overall numbers are relatively similar.
Interesting. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, that whether you're doing that triathlon on a mountain bike, on a mountain path, or they're doing it, you know, up going up hills in Iceland and you have a support crew. Yeah, the numbers don't change. What your body needs doesn't change. Just how you can get that changes. Yeah, so that makes a lot of sense. Andy, anything to add there?
I think only that we were surprised, or maybe we shouldn't have been, but we were surprised by just how high some of those numbers actually are. You know, when you talk about the fact that a few years ago it was considered, you know, 60 grams an hour was considered to be a lot of carbohydrate. There was this theoretical ceiling that maybe 90 was as much as people could do. The average on the bike in our triathlon data set is 96 grams an hour.
Wow.
And that's, as Em said, that skews towards successful elite age groupers, professional athletes and stuff. So what we're not trying to say is that everyone should be aspiring to those numbers, but
sure,
it definitely
I could not hit those numbers. No, I would throw up if I tried hitting those numbers. And Andy, we've talked before with you about training our gut. Like, it takes some gut training, even for the pros, to get to those numbers, correct?
Absolutely. We're just publishing a set of data on Leon Chevalier, French athlete who we've worked with since the start of his long course career, where he started off at about 80 grams an hour and has progressed all the way to 116 grams an hour on his way to place at the Ironman World Championships in Nice this year. And then, and so there's the gut training piece. And also, I think the other part of that conversation that's very valid and worth having is that Leon needs 100 plus grams an hour because he's pushing 300 watts on the bike and running a 239 marathon. If you're pushing 150 watts on the bike and running a 430 marathon, your actual rate of energy burn is not as high. So the requirement and the benefit from pushing your carb numbers as high is perhaps not going to be there. So but yeah, I was honestly, when those stats were first presented, I was like, maybe we should rerun the numbers because we got a mistake in our calculation. it was pretty high numbers.
Yeah, I'm always really good about sending questions in advance to our guests. And so this admittedly is one that is not on the sheet. And so we'll see if you know these stats off the top of your head. But as we're talking about triathlon specific events, let's talk about the breakdown between more elite athletes, whether they're pros or elite age groupers, versus people like me. I am in the data set as a very average middle of the pack triathlete, you know, with my 12:30 something Ironman finish time. You know, what are you seeing in the differences between those more elite athletes who maybe need more carbohydrate because they're burning more versus our mid pack and back of the pack folks who maybe don't need as much? What are the differences in numbers you're seeing?
I think we're seeing it exactly what you'd expect. Amateurs taking on a little bit less, but it's not kind of as, it doesn't drop down to like 60 grams per hour overall. It would just be slightly less in terms of the overall average grams per hour. But when you look at kind of other differences and you look at like male and females, there's less of a difference. But when we do compare our pros and our amateurs, you see the pros taking on slightly more.
Okay, yeah, which is very, very interesting. I think it's good for us to know that it's less, but not a ton less. And when we do see those really cool graphics after something like, you know, after Nice, we see the graphic hit social media on the PFNH social media account. Leon Chevalier took 118 grams of carbohydrate per hour. Okay, it's good for us to know not to aspire to that. It's cool knowing that. So just for the rest of us, we can dial it down a little bit from there. So really, really helpful.
I think the way to think about that, Andrew, is that it's not the ability to take 118 grams an hour that's making Leon a great athlete. It's that because Leon's a great athlete, he needs 118 grams an hour to support the rest of his metabolism. It's definitely there's like horse cart here, not cart horse.
Copy that.
Yeah.
Reading you loud and clear, over and out. So let's shift to talking about running some. So that's some good triathlon conversation there, and you can absolutely go back and listen to previous episodes we've done with Andy to hear more about how to fuel for different triathlon-specific events. I'm going to move us on to running events. A lot of our community does marathons, 5Ks, 10Ks, ultra events throughout the year at different times of year. When triathletes shift their focus to standalone running events, does anything need to change in our fueling and hydrating approach?
Oh, it's a good question. I think a big part in the recommendations and the headline numbers is the duration and intensity of their run or the event and race they're doing. And that plays a big part in terms of what they'd be aiming for in grams per hour and things like that. And hydration is a lot more individual. So that's the biggest thing that might play a part in the difference in those headline numbers. When we look at bringing it back to triathlon, if we compare in our data set marathon and then an Ironman marathon off the back of the swim and the bike, it's a little bit different. So we're actually seeing people fuel better and fuel a little bit more in the triathlon. So our average on the run there would be 73 grams per hour. But when we take our standalone marathon data set, it's a bit lower, 65 grams per hour. And I think that's probably what you'd expect. So off the back of the bike in a swim where you're feeling low on energy, you're able to fuel more. And obviously the logistics are a bit different as well. We are seeing our marathon runners take on slightly less. And that's not saying that they need to take on slightly less. It's just what we see in the data. The recommendations are pretty similar. Higher carbohydrate levels help fuel you and increase your performance. But in our data, we are seeing lower numbers for marathons standing on its own.
Okay. And so part of that, it sounds like, is just because when we're starting a marathon or we're starting a half marathon in a triathlon event, you know, we've already burned a tremendous amount of calories and we're in a deficit and we're trying to keep our body moving for the remainder of the event. Whereas for a standalone marathon, you know, you're just trying to fuel properly to get to that finish line. You're not starting that marathon, half marathon at an energy deficit. Is that correct?
Definitely. So for a marathon, you'd hope that our athletes on the start line are going in well-fueled. They've had a big carb-rich breakfast. They've carb-loaded. So they're going in with high glycogen stores ready to keep fueling and keep that up. But by the time you get to the Ironman marathon, you're already in quite a deficit and need to keep yourself going.
Okay. Yeah. No, good to know. And good. And so I will do half marathons. I have yet to do a standalone marathon. And I do want to eventually. I am curious to see what kind of time I could hit. And so it's just good to know that when we race triathlon a majority of the year, we kind of get that triathlon fueling like mindset inside of us, right? That we just have to stay fueled. I can't die on that run. And so we do need to shift our mindset going to a standalone running event that, hey, you need the fuel, but not as aggressively as you do for a triathlon. So that's very, very interesting. Emily, do you see that? Do you see ultra runners that are going over a marathon, that are going 50K, 100K, 100 miles? Are they fueling more like triathletes, or is it still kind of similar to a marathoner?
In terms of the numbers, I say it's similar to triathletes. We're seeing higher numbers. I think it's around 72 grams per hour for our ultra runners, and that's over like 10, 11 hours on average.
Okay.
So we are seeing higher, but when we look at how they're doing that, so what products they're using, it's a little bit different. Obviously, for ultras where you're going at a lower relative intensity, there's a bit more real food and some solids in there as well as gels and drink mix.
Yeah, no, super helpful. Yeah, I've got one of my cousins that actually lives near me. He'll tell me stories from his 100-mile races, 100K races, where, you know, he's stopping and having quesadillas, you know, at the aid stations, where you would never see a quesadilla at an Ironman aid station. So, yeah, very different types of food that our ultra-run community eats, but very, very good for us to know that as we, again, I see in our groups, I mean, several of our triathletes love dabbling in trail running and love doing an ultra. And I think that same mindset, you know, if an Ironman appeals to you, well, yeah, why wouldn't a 100-mile trail event appeal to you as well? So super helpful there, guys. So precision fuel and hydration has long been used by cyclists, but this year, actually, you became the official nutrition sponsor of a world tour team. And so the PFNH bottles were all over the broadcast during the Tour de France and other marquee cycling events. Andy, what was that experience like, and what did the team learn about the fueling needs of cyclists from that experience?
Honestly, for me, stroking my own ego, it was one of the coolest experiences.
It should be. Yeah, good for you.
Ever. Because if you'd have told me when we started this business, you know, essentially in the shed in my garden, that one day the products we'd be making and the advice that we'd be giving would be used by some of the actual best riders, you know, in the world, in the Tour de France, in the Milan-San Remo, and in all of those epic, you know, kind of iconic events, I would have either fallen off my chair. I probably wouldn't have, you know. And so, although, you know, and I think just further on that point, to have people I haven't seen or heard from for years texting me pictures they've taken of their TV screen saying, "I've seen your bottles in the Tour de France."
Yeah,
it's just like unbelievable. We also, Lotto, I have to give the team a shout out because we've worked with lots of athletes, we've worked with lots of teams over the years, we've worked with lots of great people. But the Lotto team have been an absolute joy to work with. They've fully embraced the idea. The reason they wanted to work with us is they could have, like most of the Pro Tour teams, they could have their pick of sports nutrition partners.
Absolutely, yeah.
But they, a couple of their riders, and again, shout out to Victor Campenaerts, who is the hour world record holder. Victor was using our products a few years ago off his own back, and he put them in front of the team and prodded the team and said, if you want to be serious about giving us the best performance stuff, check these guys out. And so he brought the team to the table, and we went to the table to talk to them. And even at that point, I thought, well, they're going to want, like, you know, millions of dollars from us, and we're just going to do this. But they wanted to actually work with us, seeing as a performance partner for the team, not a sponsor of the team.
Oh,
so
we've
integrated with a nutritionist, we've talked to the riders, we've learned a lot, we've reformulated some of our products, we've developed an entirely new product for their purposes, something called the Carb Only Drink Mix, because they wanted to get, we didn't appreciate just quite how much carbohydrate they wanted to get in liquid form. And they couldn't do it without overloading on the sodium with some of our more blended products with electrolytes. So we developed the carb-only drink mix with them. And being around, like, one of the guys on the squad, Raf, one of our sports science team, he's been intrinsically working with them at some of their races, even, like, being given a jersey and being a swan year, effectively handing out
Mop
Road. Yeah. So we've got video of Raf. And hats off to him for having the balls to do this, like standing in the middle of the road when the peloton rides towards you at 40 miles an hour, and he's handing bottles off to individual riders as he goes. So our exposure, you know, to all of that has been fantastic. And we're constantly talking to them about modifications to products and what comes next. So when you get real-time feedback from people who are operating at that level, and also from people who are consuming that much of your product. Like, nobody, in my estimation, uses more product than a World Tour cycling team. They do so many hours of training that, you know, they just use so much product. So the turnaround on feedback is strong. You know, they will tell you what's working and what's not working, and it's allowed us to sharpen up our game for sure.
I one time, Andy, just as we're talking about it being a pinch me moment for you, seeing your bottles on the Tour de France course. I remember scrolling social media one time, and George Russell, Mercedes rider for and driver in Formula One, had a picture. It was him. It wasn't in a sports context. I think he was on a beach, but he had a PFNH bottle in his hand, in his Instagram photo. And I took a screenshot of it and texted it to my wife, who watches Formula One with me. And that was pretty cool to me. Seeing your bottles on the Tour de France course, is that the one that, like, tops of the list for you, or is there anything else that really tops it in terms of just cool moments for your brand?
Yeah, there's that. You've mentioned the Formula One. I think we also got someone else sent us that during the Football World Cup, there was a tube of our PH1500 electrolytes caught in the background of the England dressing room.
Oh, yeah.
On the shelf with Jack Grealish, who's one of the top players. And although there was no reference made to it or no comment to it, you know, that was pretty cool. We've had a similar thing in the dressing room with the England rugby team. So the other one for me as well, which is not so much a public one, is that we got sent a jersey from the Green Bay Packers, which I think I might have told you about before, signed by Aaron Rodgers, because the Packers have been a long time, you know, sort of customer of PFNH. So just kind of knowing that what you've done is, what we do as a company is trusted by some of these people at the very, very sharp end of sport. People who could basically choose to do what they like or use what they like. When it's not part of an endorsement, when it's part of them just saying, if everything I could use, I'm going to use your stuff. That's quite satisfying.
Yeah. Very, very cool. And so we talked about the Tour de France, and you got to work with those guys hands-on. And so from, I'm sure, case studies with those guys and case studies with just standalone cyclists who are not on a World Tour team, you know, what have you learned about how triathletes should change their fueling approach when they head into a cycling-only event?
A similar answer to kind of what I said earlier about running, but it greatly varies depending on the duration intensity of the ride that they're going to do and the race that they're going to do. I think what Andy said about the tour riders, we've seen them hitting really high carb numbers, and our cycling case studies do show that on average there are 87 grams per hour, so at the top end of the recommendations, closer to 90 compared to our running ones, which sit lower and closer to 70. But again, it's the logistics that change a lot from race to race and between the disciplines. I think with cycling, it's lots about these carb-rich bottles, so using carb-only drink mix or using the flow gel as a way to get these strong and high volumes of carbs and carry that with you and not have to the faff of opening wrappers and bits and pieces like that.
Yeah, I would just to echo, just to sort of emphasize that, I think the biggest difference we see is the use of liquid carbs, really, overall. They're, because of the nature of cycling expect to get a lot of their calories from their bottles, and they get through a high volume of fluid. So we were amazed with how many bottles of carb-only drink mix some of the Lotto riders will crush in a single stage of the tour. And I think that's because cycling is very stochastic and unpredictable. You know, they can be sprinting. If the race is fast, the chances of like getting a gel out of your pocket and having time to take your hand off your handlebars and do that, whereas getting a bottle and taking a mouthful of drink is a lot easier. So we'd have expected, I think, more of a shift towards gels and bars for their energy when we're seeing them take it a lot in terms of liquid carbs.
Yeah, that is interesting. And I imagine just for our listeners, you know, I do know we have some folks that do things like mountain bike events and cyclocross events and crit style racing where it is unpredictable, like you're talking about. And so maybe they need to trend towards getting their carbohydrate, getting their fluids in through the fluids, right? And maybe some of us that do those century rides where we're riding 100 miles just for fun on a weekend with some friends and we're not so worried about our time. We can probably enjoy the bars and enjoy the gels and not be in a hurry there. So that's interesting to hear as you're talking about those learnings. So the next category for our folks, and you mentioned earlier at the top of the show, swim run, that there are swim run events. I know, Andy, you're a big fan of doing swim run races. There are some swim only events, though they're not as common, but there are some swim only events. I think it becomes very difficult to fuel during a swim-only event. What are you seeing from your swim-run athletes or swim-only athletes in terms of what they should do for fueling?
Yeah, the interesting thing about swim-run and swim-only is the level of self-sufficiency that's often required. I suppose if we start with swim-run, I've done a lot of that, and typically those races will put you out in the wilds with very limited access to aid stations, so you've got to get creative about what you're carrying. So figuring out how to get enough gels and things inside your wetsuit, we wear these like kangaroo pouch kind of vests that go underneath, which have pockets in the front so you can unzip the front zip and access those. But it's amazing how much you have to be prepared to carry if you want to fuel properly, because you might do a 9-hour race, which has only got like 4 or 5 aid stations in it or something like that. So you do have to carry a lot. You probably also have to carry a soft flask or a drinking vessel, because a lot of these events are very eco-conscious, which is a good thing, but it means they don't give you cups. So you have to carry your drinking vessel. And so then you have to be very strategic about how much you drink and when and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of that. With open water swimming, I suppose that you could put into two distinct camps. We've worked with athletes that are doing kind of these 10,000 meter, 10K or big ocean swims, which are like unsupported. So they're kind of mass start and there just is no aid station unless you're, they sort of have special needs aid stations where you can put something like a bottle or a bag or a gel where you have to swim across to a pontoon and find it and grab it and eat it. But a lot of the time, the athletes don't bother with those. So we've heard stories of people putting gels in their swim trunks, in the wetsuit and that. But all of that is quite tricky and logistically challenging. So I think it's probably fair to say a lot of the time we see swimmers fueling suboptimally, not necessarily because they're not aware of the numbers they need to be hitting, but because it's practically difficult. Then you've got the other category of long distance swimmers that we work with, who are the ones who are doing the kind of channel crossings or ocean crossings, who will have a support boat. They're not allowed to touch the boat, and they're allowed to have people feed them, but they have to do it all hands free. So they'll have they'll either throw a bottle into the water or they'll hold them a cup on a stick, which the swimmer has to take. And we've just started conversations with a guy called Andy Donaldson, who's worth people having a look for on Instagram and on Google, because Andy just broke an incredible world record for swimming 7 major channel crossings in the world within 1 year and breaking the record for a number of them. And he got in touch because he used our gel. We didn't know about this, but he used our gels as part of his fueling strategy for
those.
Wow,
cool.
And it's been insanely insightful just starting to chat with him recently about like how he orchestrates it. And there's a video on his Instagram actually of how he takes a feed bottle, you know. So a lot of the time, like, he'll dilute some of our gels into water so they're super concentrated. We actually think he'll get on really well with the flow gel. He has no chance to try it yet. But just learning about it's a lot about the logistics. But I thought this has stimulated loads of conversation in our office, because we were talking about recommendations for swimmers, and maybe we need to be real that you're not going to hit 90 grams an hour when you're swimming.
Yeah.
Because of these steps. But he makes it a priority to hit 100 grams an hour, is what I'm learning. So actually, he's said overcoming the logistical hurdle of getting 100 grams an hour in is worth it for these really long swims because of the performance benefits that it brings. So we're only getting started on that kind of like extreme open water swimming journey, but we're quite excited about it.
So what I'm gathering, whether it's swim, bike, run, or triathlon, all three, is I think I anticipated more of this conversation being about the certain numbers we should be hitting in each sport. And the numbers aren't dramatically different. It's just the longer you go, the more you need. The shorter you go, the less you need. And when you do triathlon, the three disciplines, as opposed to a single discipline, you need more by default just because your body's doing more. And so going from triathlon, in most cases, to single sport, you're dropping down a little bit, but not a ton. And just the longer you go, the more it is. And a lot of this conversation has been about the logistics of getting those feedings, because the logistics change from sport to sport to sport, because sometimes you're supported, sometimes you're not. Sometimes there's aid stations, sometimes there aren't. So very insightful conversation across swim, bike, and run. And I hope our people have really taken a lot away just from what you've learned from the case studies, the athletes you've worked with. I do have two questions left, and the next one gets us out of endurance sports and perhaps into adventuring and sports, because chances are, if you are a triathlete, if you are running and swimming and biking, you know, you're probably attracted to other outdoor activities. You're probably attracted to playing some team sports or some solo sports that require fueling and hydrating. So, you know, some folks do things like, you know, hiking. Some folks like to climb. Some folks like to ski and kayak. Some people play in adult leagues for basketball, soccer, tennis. Some people are super addicted to the latest craze of pickleball. So when our triathlon audience finds themselves playing pickleball or going for a hike or going on some kayaking adventure with some friends, you know, playing some pickup basketball for a couple hours down at the gym, you know, how should we properly fuel and hydrate all these different types of endeavors that aren't necessarily endurance sports, but need to be fueled and hydrated for?
Yeah, you nailed it a minute ago, Andrew. I think lots of the recommendations go across between the disciplines. The kind of overall headline numbers transfer. It just depends on the duration and intensity of what you'd aim for. But the main thing is how you do that and the logistics around how you fuel and hydrate for your specific event that you're doing or the game that you're playing. Something like pickleball, where you might be playing a few times, if you're playing in like a tournament, it might be about how you rehydrate and you start optimally hydrated and then how you refuel between different matches and bits and pieces like that. There's different factors that come into play. And with the shorter events, with games, football, it's about going in well hydrated, going in well fueled, like you would with your triathlon. But it might be that you take on much less during and you just keep yourself well hydrated and well fueled throughout whatever kind of game or event that you're doing.
Yeah, super, super interesting. Andy, anything to add there as an adventurous spirit yourself? I know you get in the great outdoors and do a variety of things yourself. What do you find yourself doing whenever you're just going for an adventure with the lads?
Well, you and I can agree on one thing, I think, Andrew. It's that the old PF&H chews are you know, pretty good for snacking. And when I've always got a pocket full of those, and I found it's especially useful. When I was in Spain last week, with my kids, and I took them on a bit of a hike. I called it a mountain climb. That was probably overstating the hill that we climbed up. But we climbed up this hill and we did it first thing in the morning before breakfast. And, you know, luckily I had my pocket full of PF&H chews to keep everyone's blood sugar levels at the point we could all stay friends. So my main thing on those is that they're always a bit lower intensity. So I don't go into them with, you know, clearly if I'm just going for a hike or whatever, I've not got as robust a plan as I would with a marathon, but I always make sure I've got what I need with me. And usually that's, you know, a pocket full of sports nutrition is pretty convenient. Even if you forgot it there from a week ago, it's not going to go out of date and it's going to be usable. So yeah, keep your snacks on hand and eat before you get hangry. That's usually my best advice.
You know, and Andy, I think it's really, you know, us triathletes, we can take everything so gosh darn seriously that I think it's good for our people to hear from a fueling and hydrating professional. Hey, if you're gonna just do something that's an adventure with the family, an adventure with some friends, play some pickup basketball or whatever, like, yeah, okay, take some snacks, make sure you don't get hangry, but you don't have to overthink, overanalyze, overprepare for everything in your life. You know, if you're going to do a proper, you know, Grand Canyon in and out climb or go scale a mountain or something, okay, well, we'll think it through. But yeah, there's some things that just make sure some snacks are on hand and you'll be fine, right?
But yeah, take the pressure off and yeah, make it about the experience and not bog it down in the detail.
Yeah. So last question for today. I alluded already a couple times to how fun it is to see on the PF&H social media channels and on your YouTube channel. You do a good job of highlighting some of the more interesting or noteworthy case studies that go out, particularly after huge events like Nice or Kona. You're highlighting how some of those pro athletes fueled during those endeavors. When the PF&H team goes and does a race together, you'll show some of the numbers of how some of the guys and gals fueled those swim run events or whatever that the team went out and did. It's very interesting. And again, I hope our people go to the website and fire up some of the case studies and see some of the really cool work that Emily and the team is doing, because they are really cool. And everybody wants to go and see, you know, how Leon fueled Nice, how the big athletes fueled the big events. And it's cool to go see that and learn from that and see what they did. But also our numbers are our numbers and their numbers are their numbers. And so I shouldn't be trying to do what Leon did. I can look at what Leon did, but I shouldn't try to replicate it for myself. And so what would you say to our athletes as they go look at some of the case studies, as they see the posts on social media summarizing what a certain pro did here or there? How can we look at these case studies and learn from them, have some takeaways that maybe we can apply to what we're doing, while also keeping what we're doing, what we should be doing for us and hitting our own numbers, if that makes sense? That's a convoluted question, but I hope you get the point.
Yeah, it makes sense. I think it's a great question. And although the majority of our case studies are kind of elite top level successful races, I think there are lots of key takeaways. And one of them being the headline numbers, see the actual headline numbers, what people are achieving. And a key part of that, how they're actually hitting those numbers. I think that's one of the main questions we get asked, and our customer service team gets asked a lot, is how athletes are actually carrying that amount of fuel, all the hydration that they need. And you can see that in the case studies. And from that, you can use the whole database. You can look and find cases that are similar events to what you're doing or similar athletes to you, similar losses, sweat losses, and take inspiration. They're not, as you said, so much to be copied, but take inspiration of the strategy that they used. And from that, go away and do a similar process to what I do day to day and analyze your own intake, find out your headline numbers, what you've been hitting in training and races previously, and see if you can use the case studies to help refine your strategy and use that process yourself.
I would add to that, there's nothing to stop you doing case studies on yourself. You know, that's how we started out. Is I look back at my own athletic career and realize I go back through my old training diaries, and very rarely would I ever record what I ate and drank in key training sessions stuff. If I've got a debrief I've written for myself on an Ironman back in the day, it would include that stuff, but it wasn't in a lot of detail, and it never felt like that was an area that I made huge progress on over time by learning from some of those mistakes. The hydration piece was more like that for me, because that was so bad it was catastrophic. But with the fueling, I didn't really evolve my fueling, because I didn't record it and I didn't iterate it. So I think, to use Emily's phrase, take inspiration from the case studies, in the sense that not just from the numbers that are in them, but from the process that's gone through. If you can do that, or do that to a level that you're confident with on your own performances, then there's a huge amount to be gained from that.
Leave us with this today. From the case studies you've done this calendar year, at the time we're recording and posting this podcast, it is the end of 2023. I think I asked this question last time when we talked about the case study specifically, but what is one case study that you would tell our audience, hey, this is just one that I found especially interesting from this calendar year that can be the first one our folks go fire up and go watch after they listen to this episode? We'll go Andy and then Emily, and we'll call it a day. Andy, what do you think?
I would say go and look at, it's sort of 1/2. I would say go and look at the two that we've got from the stage of the Tour de France, where we got Maxime Van Gils and Victor Campenaerts, who Maxime finished second on this stage of the Tour de France that finished at the Grand Colombier, and Victor finished, you know, solidly. It was a big day out for both of them. And for me, if you want to get a true insight on what it takes to ride at the front of the pack and off the front of the pack in the Tour de France, then you'll get all the detail you want there. And that's not something that's commonly available. So that'd be my top tip.
That sounds very interesting and great perspective there. And Andy, I'll tell you this, while we were watching the Tour de France, my wife asked me one day, she was like, hey, what team are we rooting for? Are we rooting for anybody? And I was like, yeah, we're rooting for this. I showed her the jersey of the team. I was like, we're rooting for that color jersey because they're riding with PFNH as their fueling source. And so, okay, she was on board. We rooted for them the whole tour. So Emily, what is this answer for you?
It's a tough one. There are so many. But personally, I'd say Leon in Nice, his case study, because I've worked with him for over 2 years now. For me, to see the progress in all his numbers and the refinement of his strategy was great. And it to kind of that case study and the numbers and everything to show the progress over the last 2 years. And we can compare the stats, like Andy discussed earlier, from where we first worked with him, I think at Ironman Bolton 2 years ago, to Nice, and see the progress that he's made. So I'd go that one.
Great set, everyone. Let's cool down.
It's cool down time, and I'm Vanessa, your average triathlete with elite level enthusiasm. Joining me today with a coach cool down tip is Mike Rucker. Mike has an incredible background as a veteran of the U.S. Army and National Security Agency. He currently works as a federal sales director in the national security field, and we can definitely say that he is very successful at everything he does. Mike is an All-American NCAA Div 1 swimmer, Kona qualifier, and a member of the U.S. Army World Class Athlete Program. He has been coaching triathlon since 1996 and has been with TriDot since 2018. Mike loves coaching beginners and elite athletes and enjoys establishing the fundamentals with them and then optimizing their performance. Welcome to the cool down, Mike.
Hey, how are you doing today? It's a great day to be alive, great day to be a TriDot athlete.
Oh, it sure is. It is such a wonderful day. It's a little bit chilly here. I had my scarf like completely wrapped around my neck and my puffy jacket on, but the sun is shining, so I don't think you can ask for anything more than that.
Certainly.
I have very fond memories of my dad breaking out the banjo and having family sing-alongs in our basement or around the campfire. And I hear that you used to build, repair, and even play the banjo with your Uncle June.
So I did.
Do you still play?
So rarely. I no longer have an actual instrument, which I need to acquire again. Actually, my son-in-law does. Maybe I'll just borrow it. But yeah, so Uncle June, his name was actually Walter Flannery, World War II veteran. I had one lung left. So yeah, that was his, you know, kind of hobby/craft. And so, you know, I used to hang out with him after my grandfather died. And, you know, I would watch him shape the wood and then actually use the leather skins. And scrape those down and get them very thin and then stretch those over the metal frame of the banjos and tighten them up. And then actually get the neck and shape the neck and tune, get that to the right shape to be able to tune and hit the right notes. Do the crosset and the strings, and then how to tune that, and then how to pick. So I'm not a five-finger picker. I'm just a two-finger. And
yeah.
just the basic stuff, you know, like Foggy Mountain Breakdown and some of those, used to listen to a lot of bluegrass music, go to a lot of festivals, even in college. There were a lot of people that we would just have impromptu things, you know, jam sessions or somebody's basement. You know, somebody would play a banjo, somebody would play a violin, somebody would play a guitar, or stuff like that.
What a wonderful way to spend time with other people, you know, doing something like making music and building things. It's so wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, that's a talent I need to get back into and get back into practice.
Absolutely. So switching gears completely, we're going back to triathlon. What tip do you have for us today and our listeners?
So my tip today focuses on open water swimming. And statistics bear me out on that, where it's around 70% of triathletes out there, their most uncomfortable discipline is the swim. So, you know, that's, you know, we have Tridot Pool School that helps overcome basic technique stuff, but also, you know, unless it's in a pool sprint type of triathlon, most swims are going to be open water sessions. So there are no walls, there are no lane lines, navigation is above water, and so you have to accommodate sighting and so on, but mostly it's just getting comfortable with actually entering that water. Your visibility isn't as good as a nice, clean, clear pool, and especially like in a lake or in some of the places down south here where the water's got a lot of organic tannins in it, and it's like swimming in tea. So, you know, visibility is very limited. With that, then you really have to focus on being able to sight and breathe and navigate and all that. So we had a triathlete recently in one of our Facebook groups, the I Am Tridot, that posted about he'd been to pool school. He had great technique and all that. But the thing that terrified him most was an open water swim. That alone would prevent him from that. So we slowly got him matched up with local groups and even some Tridot athletes there that he could swim with and practice. And really that's what it comes down to is we prescribe the swim sessions to help to build and develop, but then almost all the coaches say every single time, get as much open water swim practice in as you can. Because what I've seen is people can hit consistently great times in the pool, but then they get in open water and they suddenly slow down, you know, 10 to sometimes 50% because the level of comfort that is not there, their breathing is way off, they can't see anything, or their goggles get jostled or get fogged up and so on. I think
sounds familiar.
Yeah. Previous tip, it's a stop, get the, you know, fog out of your glass, get your goggles and so on. But, you know, some of those things are things that we can help with drills. In the pool on navigation, you know, every 10 strokes, pop your head up, take a peek and keep going. And, I did a triathlon down in South Padre Island, and it was in the bay side. There's the ocean side and in the bay side. The bay side actually had a pretty stiff current. It was around 4 knots and it was a flood. So until you found that eddy, that seam to get out of that current, you were going to struggle. And several people did. So because they combined it with a sprint, you had to do 2 laps.
Oh, no.
So you not only got it once, you got it twice.
Yeah.
But then taking advantage of that type of current also is like an escape from Alcatraz, for example. Then you ride that current back on that flood back in that you can actually... That 6 knots, that 4 knots adds tremendous amount of speed. So where, for example, you're going like 215 per 100 out, then you're struggling a little bit, and then suddenly you're coming back about half that speed. And so, you know, that's something to also getting used to that you're not going to find in a lake usually, or maybe in a river where you've got a current assisted swim, but that's what I would recommend the most is where you get as much as open water practice as you can. Always be safe. Always have a buoy. Always have a companion or somebody on a kayak.
Now, with the prescribed program that Tridot gives, we have our 2 swims a week. How often would you suggest to your athletes to add in or to make one of those an open water swim, or to just have them add in an extra one?
It kind of gets back to it depends. So the closer to race week, I would say add those in at least once a week, if not just plain out substitute for a swim session, preferably not the speed session, which is usually Fridays. But, most people, when they have time and can have access, it's going to be on a weekend. So if you want to stick to the two prescribed sessions and then leave room on when you have that available time to add another open water session, it's never going to detract from your training stress. It's going to, be additive. But so as a coach, I like to throw those in as basically an aerobic swim. And you may or may not get a score out of it. You may or may not get anything in terms of points, but in terms of benefit, you get the benefits of familiarization, improving your navigation skills, and also dealing with calming out or eliminating your anxiety.
Thanks for joining us. Make sure to subscribe and share the TriDot podcast with your triathlon crew. For more great Tri content and community, connect with us on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. Ready to optimize your training? Head to TriDot.com and start your free trial today. TriDot, the obvious and automatic choice for triathlon training.